Okay, I just wanted to clarify something from, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks ago. We had a question that was left on the table about an onion cooked in a meat pot. We know that it becomes flacid, this idea of double tartar. We'll cover that hopefully in one of the upcoming weeks. But if I eat that onion, fried onions, it tastes delicious. If I eat that onion, am I now flacid for 6 hours? Do I need to wait 6 hours or am I fine? So I double-checked with Bednar. It comes from A, or B, Baker. I think they said in some K test. This is one of the early ones. One of the early ones in Yeridea, and then it's a Hether, plus all this stuff. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, even though you are, if the onion itself is full-fledged fleshik, it's not going to trigger having to wait 6 hours, 3 hours, 5, or whatever it is you wait. It's not going to trigger that. And it makes a lot of sense based on the reasons that we said, Rambam and Rashi, right? Rambam said you're a bit of meat stuck in between your teeth, and it takes around 6 hours for them to definitely go away or decompose. Rashi said you have the oil, shamunis, the grease that's left in your mouth and around your mouth for about 6 hours until it goes away, gets washed away, no longer potent enough to make it cause an issue. None of those are going to be problems with a double fire, even though the double fire has this special koach, this power to draw, to revivify the flacid taste, which is in the walls of the pot, and make it, we say, there's no naparnat, there's no inabinyomo, none of those factors are relevant for it. They're a fire, but still, it's not going to give you slices of meat in your mouth, it's not going to give you meat oil in your mouth. So it makes a lot of sense why that fashash is not going to exist. Okay? So I guess the on the weeks when yeshiva, when the Thursday night shalom does not actually have meat in it, because we always appreciate sponsors, but they don't always step up to the plate. So that cholin is going to be, well, it's going to be flacid, but it's not going to cause you to wait 6 hours. The onions in there, the onions cooked in that cholin, do pull out onion flacid taste, but do themselves become fully flacid, but there's no 6 hours triggered in that case. Right. Exactly.
Did it make the whole entire cholin have the same status as
just onion? Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Is that only it's cooked meat, right?
Nope, even just cooked in the pot.
It is cooked meat, right?
Could be cooked, even if it was cooked with a pyre of knife and cooked in a meat pot, it's going to have the status of fleshik, but not sugar 6 hours, and I think same with cutting with a meat knife. In fact, a knife won't have to deal with that.
Are you going
to
set your mouth?
I don't think you need to. Okay. So we're going to be dealing with Simon Sani Gimel. Sani Gimel is a funny case, and it doesn't happen as often as you may think, but it happens more than you can get it. It happens every so often. You have your flacid pots, and your milk pots. You usually use your flacid pots for meatballs and spaghetti, and you usually use your milk pots for
lasagna.
Yes. You use it for lasagna. So back in the day when I was growing up, I had a special breakfast when we were growing up, like the Sunday breakfast, we didn't have to go to school, which was only until like fourth grade. So the special breakfast, winter vacations, was something called Daisa. Does anybody know what Daisa is? Yes, very good, thank you. Somebody knows what Daisa is. Daisa is, in English, it's called Farina. I think that's a brand name. Farina is delicious, Daisa is delicious. It's basically...
I think it's in Hebrew,
it's okay, so it's like pounded flour, like brown flour, whatever. It's some sort of processed flour, wheat seed, and some sort of like wheat seed, pounded wheat seed. You add some water. Farina, that's what it's called. Yeah, not exactly sure what it is, but it's delicious. You can either make it with milk or water. It becomes like this oatmeal type, if anybody knows grit, it's similar to grit. And then you eat it with I don't know, honey, raisins, all the good things. This is like our special breakfast when we were growing up. So the way my mother would make it, this is a labor-intensive way, is you put milk on the stove, and you'd have to like stand there stirring the milk on the stove for a very long time, 10 minutes or something, it's crazy. And then, very slowly, you pour in like a cupful of this farina powder, whatever it is, stirring the entire time. And it takes a very long time, but it's made with love, and it's delicious, and it plumps up and gets very, very yummy. The other way to do it, which I found out recently, is you can just like put water in a bowl with the farina, put it in the microwave, and then you like do it for a minute, stir a little bit, put it back in, do it for like every 30 seconds until it's ready. That's how I do it. I don't know if that's a chisarm in me. I don't know what that is. But it works almost as well. But my mother used to make it with milk standing over the stove, whatever. So let's say we took that farina pot, which is very much bleos of milk, very, very milky in that pot, and then accidentally used it one day for meatballs. You got confused, you were tired, no idea what happened. You just pulled the wrong pot out of the cabinet and you used it for meatballs. What is the status of meatballs? What is the status of the pot? And the third question, what's the status of any of the utensils that you use to stir that pot? Those are the three big questions whenever you make these types of mistakes, and these questions do come up. Where you have a roommate, you're in college, and your roommate has no idea that kashrus is a thing, and he thinks that you're a nice guy, so he feels that you have no problem with him borrowing your stuff, borrowing your pots. This does happen also. And now you find out that he used your farina pot for meatballs. What do you do now? So, what's the number one question? You call your rabbi, you call him up and say, hey, rabbi, here's what happened. Farina pot is delicious, but they made meatballs in it. What do I do? So the first question, what's he going to ask? Yes, very good. Question number one is, has it been 24 hours since the last time this pot was used, presumably with milk? It was used on the fire with milk. That's the first question. What we spoke about last week, not bar not. You may think that not bar not would come to this question. The problem is it does not, right? Let's just kind of work through it. I cooked milk in this pot, so the milk taste goes into the wall. That was one taste transfer. Now, when the milk is coming out of the wall, isn't that already a second taste transfer, which we said? I'm going to fix this just to make sure Adam's okay. Oh, I guess I didn't check this. Okay, I just missed it. Not for not. So when the taste comes out of the walls of the pot, shouldn't that be a second taste transfer? And therefore, we said, if that didn't, well, hopefully you're not going to do that. But bidi evid, it should be fine. Second taste transfer is not strong enough to cause an itzer basar b'chalav. Why is this even a question? Why is this even a problem? Right. So that's not a factor. Why is it not a factor? We said that not bar not only kicks in when the particles, when the tam that's in the walls of the kli get a chance to land. They need to land in a neutral substance before they actually take on the status of a second taste transfer, of a not bar not. So in all the examples we spoke about, the taste lands in the fish. That's when it became not bar not. The taste lands in the pasta. That's when it became not bar not. If it even lands in water, if that's the only thing you're cooking in the pot, that would make it into not bar not. But as the particles are coming out of the walls of the kli, we're assuming they still have the koach. They still have the power, the quality, the qualitative ability to mix with the other type and create full-fledged basar b'chalav. So not bar not is not part of the discussion here. You have real meat cooked in a meat pot. Not bar not is not going to help us. So we have to figure out what can we do. What's the status of the food, the kli, and whatever utensils were used in the stirring. So, like we said, it's a
numbia. What about like sponge?
Yes, that is definitely discussed. It's a problem. Part of the question is you may even have bain on sponges. You may actually have like real particles of food on sponges, depending on what you've been cleaning.
Even though you soak, that makes it.
So even when you use, so soap is a tzad b'hakel, like a dabra pagom, a poking, dabra poking, we spoke about last week, but it's not necessarily going to deal with all of the issues. Yes, but normally when you're washing dishes, you're using water.
Cold water.
We said last time we spoke a little bit about washing dishes. Cold water is your best bet, or not hot water. Warm dishes probably okay. Not hot water is your best bet in washing dishes because it avoids all potential problems. As long as the water is definitely below the absolute lettuce boil, you cannot have problems when washing your dishes. The way to check if something is definitely below the absolute lettuce boil is if you can keep your hand in the stream of water for about a minute without having to pull it out, then you're definitely under the absolute lettuce boil. There are, but she does, there's a range from like 110 degrees Fahrenheit to 170, I think. It's a pretty big range, and we go to Chumrah for the different questions. Shabbos is going to be one question, Kashrus is going to be a different question. We generally go to Chumrah, so the way to know that you're not hitting the absolute lettuce boil when you're washing the dishes is if you can keep your hand under the stream for a full minute without a problem, then not yet to let it go. There are people who have burnt off like the touch receptors on the feel on their hands, called mommy hands. That's apparently the going name for it. So if you have mommy hands, you probably are not able to judge, because it could definitely still be hot enough. It's a real thing. Look it up. Mommy hands. Ask your mommy about it. she probably has them.
So this pan would be fine with cold water.
When you're washing a pan with cold water, yeah, you can't have problems with the ears. Even if it's a dairy sponge, yeah. Great. happy to give you that answer.
We don't cook at the dorms, but if we did, a roommate accidentally managed
to get
a
dairy sponge on a place you can. Roommates mess everything up. So you have to make sure your roommate comes in for cash with you. Also, that's why colors are helpful. The clearer you can have different things. You can keep things separate, the better it is down the line or long run. If you're using cold water, you're okay. And Baruch Hashem Yeshiva doesn't give us that water in the sink, so you can have kashrus problems. Good. So in our case, we said, so it depends, ben yomo or einu ben yomo. When was the last time that you used this clean? So hopefully you remember. If you remember, you can give a straight answer. If you don't remember, what's the deal? So in general, we have the assumption most kelim are einu ben yomo. Remember, you're usually able to assume, especially if you're pulling it out of the cabinet, most kelim are einu ben yomo, and that's going to give you a huge kula we're going to talk about in a minute. Most kelim you assume have not been used in the past 24 hours. If you know that it's been used within the past 24 hours, or potentially if it's hanging out in your drain board, meaning you just washed it, then you should think a lot harder. And there may be a little bit more of a reason to be choshesh. You just washed it, that means you used it recently. You should be able to, based on context, you should be able to piece together when this kli was used, when the spot was used. But if you really don't remember, I think we generally assume most kelim are in the yomim. If there's a reason to be choshesh, then you should call up your rabbi and ask, say, hey, I'm not totally sure when I used this kli. It was out of the counter, it was in the drain board, and for some reason I can't remember if it was used, maybe my wife used it, and I'm not able to ask her right now, what's the deal? But your number one factor is the kli, is the pot ben yomo or einu ben yomo. So we're going to go through two scenarios. What happens if the kli was ben yomo? What happens if the kli was einu ben yomo? And this is all, like you said, in the Tzadi Gimel of Yerudea. He breaks this down very, very nicely. First of all, what do we mean by ben yomo? We mentioned this a little bit last week, just to say it again. The classic understanding of ben yomo is machlokes, but the way we pass him definitely is that ben yomo means it has not been used in a full 24 hours. Right, 24-hour period. If you use it last at 2 p.m. on Sunday, then it's going to be ben yomo until 2 p.m. on Monday. Now we don't really take shows money, since that kind of makes a full 24 hours. The other opinion, this is Rabbi Natan, he brought up by the Mechaber in Kuf Chof Aleph, at least as an option, we don't pass on like it, but it is discussed. It's called Linas Laila, that once a night has passed, then it's no longer called ben yomo. So if I use the pot, let's say, at 4 p.m., on Sunday, then already by 8 a.m., 6 a.m., whatever it is, once the night has passed, it's already considered einu ben yomo, which is very, very useful, gives us a huge hetzer. So it would be nice to be able to get the status of einu ben yomo so much earlier, but like you said, we don't generally pass them like it. Just to be aware that shita's out there. Once in a while, it may be used as a theorem, as one of many factors to come up with a kula when necessary, and shas of chak, hatch of gadol, something like that, but generally, ben yomo, somebody says ben yomo, what meets the problem to your mind is 24 hours. Yeah. Good question. So when we say the last time it was used was within 24 hours, that was when it was hot on the fire. Hot on the fire and got to the level of, you have to let it go.
So when it's off the fire, it's just like burning hot.
Yeah. A little bit of an open question, but that shouldn't be so much time. Like within half an hour, it's going to drop low or something. It's going to drop low. Yeah,
so let's
touch it for a minute. Yeah. But that's a good question. I'm not sure if we go. The general thought is that it was last on fire. If you took it off at some point and let it sit, I'm not sure what you'd have to do. You may have to wait a little bit longer, but that's a good question. I don't know. That's a general question about the status of a kli rishon. So it's a Shabbos question also. Is a kli rishon only when it's on the fire, or is it considered a kli rishon even off the fire? Maybe a machlokes probably Yerushalmi. That's something we should definitely discuss. It's a good question. Okay, so we know that ben yomo is 24 hours. Now, let's say I cooked dairy in a meat pot within 24 hours of the last use with hot meat. So you have a meat pot, and I'm cooking dairy inside, or a dairy pot with meat inside. What's the deal? The food is aser. You just answered your food, great job, your food is trade. You have butter buffalo hanging out in your kitchen. If there was a Messina's Tom, and then the pot is going to need to be kosher. those two things, the food is trace, the pot needs to be kashered, and whatever kli you're using is presumably going to be absorbing basar b'chalav taste and will also need to be kashered. This is all assuming you're able to kasher. There are some materials we'll deal with, hagalas kelim or hasharas kelim later, but there are some kelim, some materials which are able to be kashered, some which are not able to be kashered. Anybody know the basic breakdown?
Ceramic.
Very good. Ceramic, clay sharas, cannot be kashered. Most other kelim can be kashered. Metal is most kelim in your kitchen can be kashered. Well, porcelain is a complicated thing we call that sharas. And those are not kashered. There's a tshuva from Rav Moshe. There's a tshuva from Rav Moshe that talks about really expensive china. Somebody inherited fine china from not from relative. He wanted to know, is there any way that I can use, presumably it was used and absorbed, there was a little trace in there, and he wanted to know, is there any way I can kasher and use this like fine, nice china, even though we know generally we don't kasher klecheres. So I think Rav Moshe gave a heter as long as it went unused for 12 months. After 12 months, we assume that whatever taste has been inside is definitely pagum, and therefore you can, even l'chachila, you can start using those dishes again. I think that was the response. Plaster. In terms of kashering plaster, we're going to deal with tovel and all this stuff later. In terms of kashering, I think we say that you're able to kasher hard plastic. Most post-Mizuni, you can kasher hard plastic. You need to, but you can tovel hard plastic as opposed to giving it the status. Well, I think one shita says you don't need to. The other shita says, one extreme says you don't need to. Similar to glass, you would not need to tovel ever. The other shita says that it does have bleos and cannot be kashered like chayres. So, we generally assume like the middle. It does have bleos, but can be kashered. Well, we'll deal with that hopefully in a later shita. So, one of the factors was, obviously it's only going to become usher if there was nesinat tam. Right, there's nesinat tam from the walls of the kli into the food that you're cooking there, right? My farina pot, my oatmeal pot, whatever it is, which is milky, if it's able to give over milk taste into my meatballs, that's when I'm going to have a problem. So how am I supposed to find out if there's milk taste in my meatballs? What? The obvious answer is I should take a bite. What's the obvious thing? What's the obvious problem with me taking a bite? Is that Russian roulette? It's a big gamble. If it doesn't taste like milk, then hey, you're good. No missing us time. Move on with your life. If it does taste like milk, big problems. What?
Get a food goy.
Get up. Oh, exactly. You need a food goy. Everybody needs their neighborhood food goy. So this is in the Gemara. This is called a kfela. Kfela is a chef, non-Jewish chef, somebody who is a bucky in being able to detect taste. Does it taste like meat? No, it does not taste like milk. His senses are finally honed, Ratatouille style. He knows what he's doing. He will be able to detect if you have traces of milk in your meatballs or not. So you just go next door, knock on your neighbor's door, say, hey, can you take these meatballs? I think they're delicious, but I want to make sure. Does it taste like milk or not? That's how you can test if something has been seen at town. There are some issues with that we're going to talk about. What's the one other thing you might be able to rely on in terms of determining town? There's a magic number which is thrown around kashas all the time. Shishim. So there are two ways of understanding. We'll deal with this with shishim. When we get to tarobas, if we do get to tarobas, that's probably the most one of the most complicated parts of your day. We'll see if I can get there. But the number which is thrown around by tarobas and by bittul is shishim. One of two ways of understanding the call of shishim is that Chazal, the Rabbanim, did a lot of experiments. They were testing out, I guess they had a few guys who liked to eat food, they were testing out at what point does taste disappear, at what ratio does taste disappear when it's absorbed into another food. And the number, the magic number that they came up with, that would be a fail safe in all cases, was 60. Now what do I mean that that's a fail safe? It's not that it's always the taste is going to be there until 1 in 59, and then suddenly, magic, by 60 it disappears. There's some tastes which are going to be weaker, some tastes which are going to be stronger. So it could be that already 1 in 40, I'm not going to be able to taste, at a ratio of 1 in 40, I'm not going to be able to taste milk in my meatballs, but there's no way of me knowing that. Once I know that I have shishim there, I'm definitely going to be okay. There's no detectable milk taste, and once there's no detectable milk taste, we assume it's buttail, pitzel b'shishim, you are okay. So that's the other thing we were going to be able to rely on. In this case, bittul b'shishim. We have nesinat tam, checking with a guy, and shishim. Yeah, got it.
Have we determined who's failing nowadays?
Oh, so we'll talk about that. Good question. Yeah.
Is bittul b'shishim, that means it has to be hot?
We're going to go into it right now. Yeah. Good? Okay. what, so we spoke about what is binyomo, we're dealing with nitinas ta'am. So the first, the underlying klal of nitinas ta'am being a problem is the idea of ta'am ke'ekar. The fact, the assumption, that ta'am is dealt with is assumed to be just as potent as the taste itself. Granted that I don't have actual physical milk here, it's not like there's a cow standing in my kitchen that I'm milking directly into this pot, into my meatballs, but there's a ta'am of milk. So how do we look at this ta'am? How do we look at this taste? Is it particles? Is it considered mamashos? Is it considered different? That's a big machlokes, yes? Question is, ta'am ke'ikar is de'oraita or de'rabbanan? We're going to assume that ta'am is like the food itself, is that it's in de'oraita or it's in de'rabbanan. So definitely by basar b'chalav, it seems like the entire institution of basar b'chalav is built on ta'am ke'ikar. At least for basar b'chalav, it must be a din de'oraita. Otherwise, what is the problem of cooking a gadeed b'chalei b'mo if the only thing which is transferring over is meat taste into the milk? I can't drink that milk later because there's meat taste in there. I can't eat that meat because there's milk taste. There's no mamushes in there. There's the taste has been absorbed. So the entire idea seems to be based on assuming ta'am ke'ikar is midoraita. It is an open question for other types of treifos, other things, other isuri achila, but it seems like for basar b'chalav, it's pretty well, you're pretty able to assume that it is presumably they're right. So there is one way of saying no. There is one way of responding to that idea. But definitely road posts can hold the ta'am ke'ikar generally is there, right? So why do we care? What's the nafkamina? What happens if your soup or the meatballs that you're making, they spilled out? And now you're no longer able to test, did I have shishim in the pot or not? You have a suffix. Subject to Raisa Lakumra, subject derabanan, Lakula. So if we assume ta'am ke'ikar be deraisa, you would need to go Lakumra in this case. Since you have no way of finding out if I had shishim at some point or not, you'd have to assume that the food would remain trace. Okay, so that's the idea of ta'am ke'ikar, subject deraisa. So we said we have two things. We have the shishim and we have the ti'imas kefela. We're going to go into the ti'imas kefela. What's the deal with this, having a guy taste your food for you? How does that even work? And then we're going to deal a little bit with the shishim question. So how does this idea of relying on a goy work? What, are there any other areas of halacha where we actually rely on a goy for yisurim? When do we rely on a goy? So he can do things for you, but that's not what the guy is doing here. Is he's not doing a davar usher for you. He's setting a reality. He's telling us, are these meatballs trafe or not? Do they have a blia of trafe or not? So that's basically aids, right? The same way an aid is able to tell you that, I don't know, this cow is shefted properly, we're having this guy tell me, here's the reality as I see it. Since when do we trust Goyim as our agent? That's really weird. No? Okay, so that's one way we can say that it's really milta. But there is still, even if it's not formal agents, there's definitely na'amanis involved. Since when do Goyim have na'amanis in order to tell us what is the reality that we need to deal with? They're not taking this nearly as seriously as we do. Why should we give them any sort of net money? Yeah.
Is there income?
What's the benefit?
They're getting confused.
They get a taste. I'm not sure how much they're going to get. If I guess you could say that they have motivation to let soar. They have motivation to oxygen if you're going to give them the food. I don't know if that. I'm not sure that's the factor. I don't think we really talk about that. So I'm not sure if that's going to help us. That's a good svara, but I'm not sure that's going to help us after here. We have a couple of things. Number one. When we say fela, when we say a chef, is that doctor or lab doctor? Do we really mean the guy needs to be a professional chef? Or do we say some random guy who happens to be a foodie, who's able to detect minute tastes, or even a sound guy who's gonna be able to taste our meatballs and tell us, can I taste milk in it or not? Doctor or lab doctor? That's definitely my focus we've shown him. What we gain if we assume doctor is very interesting. Let's say you have a top chef, 5-star restaurant, and he happens to be your neighbor. So you go next door and you ask him, is there a taste of milk in this thing or not? And he tells you, yeah, I tasted it, it's totally fine, there's no milk in there. And then you take a bite, and what happens? There's milk, I taste milk! You're going to go to all your Jewish friends, you're going to tell them, it's going to become the talk of the town, this 5-star chef who's supposed to be so good, who's supposed to be so in tune with food and taste and whatever, he messed up. He doesn't really know. He's not really good at his job. So this kfeila, this non-Jewish chef, assuming that it's Dafka, he's going to think my reputation is on the line. I need to be really on my game. I need to tell the truth. I need to be honest. And I need to make sure that I'm giving the right answer for this question. Because he knows otherwise, I'm going to lose my 5 stars. I'm going to lose my reputation as a high-quality chef. So if Kfela Dafka, that's one way, that's one thing we're able to rely on. He's probably going to do a great job. He's going to tell us the reality because he has money in the game. It's important for him to make sure he gets the right answer because he doesn't want to lose his reputation. So that's Shita Tosfos thinks we're dealing with a real Kfela, and therefore we have that's a great way to help us trust what he says. In terms of Psak, we pass in Kfela Lav Dafka, which hurts us in terms of that money, but it helps us in making this at least shy of to find people. I know, living in Gross, I don't have non-Jewish chefs with my next-door neighbor. I don't even know if there are any non-Jewish chefs in Bayit HaGan. So if you were saying Dafka, it would be very, very difficult to find somebody who can do this type of test. Once we pass in Kfela Lav Dafka, it at least becomes a lot more relevant. The reason the Gemara used the Lashon of Kfela is just to kind of point out, it's a chef-type job. It's a job for somebody who's going to be able to detect nuances in food, but not specifically somebody who's employed as a chef at a restaurant or something like that. So Rashi has a different answer. How are we able to trust this non-Jew based on what he says? A klal, which shows up in other areas of halacha, specifically by na'amanus for non-Jews, and specifically for non-Jews, the idea of mesiach lefi tumo. Mesiach lefi tumo means he's just speaking as a unwittingly, he's speaking without knowing exactly what is what we have at stake. The guy presumably does not realize that the reason we're asking him, do you taste milk in this thing or not, is because it's determining whether we're going to be able to eat the food. He doesn't know about kashrus halacha, the kashrus in any of this stuff. He just thinks he's a nice guy, he wants me to taste the food and see if I like it or not. He's asking me a random question. So there's no motivation for him to say either, oh yeah, don't worry, it's totally fine, or no, I definitely detect milk. He's going to answer honestly, because he doesn't realize what we're going to be using it, what we're going to be using the information for. We use Mesiach Bitumo in other areas of halacha as well to allow us to trust something that we hear from a non-Jew. So Mesiach Bitumo should apply here.
Except for holding goy.
What?
Except for goy holding
kashrus. Ah, so that actually comes up, surprisingly. Potentially you might even need both factors. You may have needed Kfela in terms of the sensitive taste buds, and then Mesiach Bitumo would be what allows us to trust him, which would make it super difficult. I need to find a Kfela and then ask him in a way that he's Mesiach Bitumo? Not the easiest thing. The Rambam has a present sheet that I think we'll just skip it. Okay. So what's the deal? We have Kfela, Dafka, Lav Dafka, and we have the idea of Mesiach Bitumo. Seems to be Mesiach Bitumo is really what we can rely on to trust a guy who tastes our food. Good. So what do we do practically? Do we rely on this? Do we use this idea? Or do we not? So the Ramah already told us in Simon Sadi Bey, the one before this one, that we generally don't rely on Ti'i Mas Kfela. Our current practice, even though it definitely was right up in the Gemara, it used to be something we would rely on, we're not going to rely on it anymore. We're not so comfortable with the idea of relying on a non-Jew tasting the food. Why not? What changed? Two shitas, the Shach and the Lavush. The Shach says, we don't rely on non-Jews anymore. And one svara as to why not, because they may have found out what exactly was going on, exactly like Eitan said. They've been around the block enough. The OU is a worldwide organization. Non-Jews have started picking up ideas of kashrus. If the Kiva was still here, he would tell us in the restaurant that he was working at over the summer. The Mexican chefs who worked at the pizza store were holding in chumras and kulas and shitas. These guys really knew their stuff. There are non-Jews out there. Over time, they get to know Hilchos Kashrus. So once he knows why exactly I'm asking, we no longer have the ne'emanus of Mesiach Lefi Tumo. That was the Shach suggestion why the Ramah was not so happy with relying on Mesiach Lefi Tumo. The Lavush said, we're just not as sensitive to taste anymore. It's not a question of Jewish versus non-Jewish. We're just not as sensitive to taste. We're not going to be able to pick up the nuances. We wouldn't pick up the small amount of milk which is absorbed into my meatball. The obvious difference is there are times where we sometimes need a Jew to taste food. This is interesting and really only fascinating to throw. What happens if I have truma, which gets cooked with chulin? Who's the only person who's allowed to eat that mixture? A kohen. So if there's a potential for bittul mishishim, or bittul b'meah, I think truma is bittul b'meah, not mishishim, I can go to a kohen. Well, it would depend on this machlokas, the shach versus the bush. Could I go to a kohen and say, can you taste this mixture and tell me if you taste whatever truma thing was that just fell in? According to the Shas, it's just a question of Ne'emanus and non-Jews, but in this case, obviously we still trust the Kohen. According to the Lavush, nothing to do with Jewish versus non-Jewish, it's just how sensitive are we to taste. We would not be able to rely on that Kohen nowadays. So the Ramah says we don't rely on taste. We had two reasons. We're not going to rely on Tima Kfela. The only thing we're dealing with was Shishin. The Mechaber seems to assume that we would still be open to relying on a TMS Fela. At that point, you would need Masech HaBitumo, but you would not, it seems like you would not need a Fela. You can just ask a Sam random going up the street, hey, do you taste anything in these meatballs? If you taste the milk, then it's straight. If you don't taste the milk, then you are okay. So we're going to go with the Ramah, assuming that you're going for Shishin. The Ramah says you measure based on the entire pot. So I don't know if this is geometry or trigonometry, I don't know exactly which discipline of math we're getting into right now, but you need to take the volume of the out of the circumference of the outside of the pot, the volume of, I guess really, the volume of the pot itself, how much space could have been absorbed into that pot, and then compare that to the volume that the pot itself holds. If the volume is more than 60, then you're fine. If it's less than 60, 1 to 40, 1 to 30, whatever it is, then it's going to be tricked because we assume the bleos, the tam, has not been buzzled, was not canceled out. So that sounds very complicated. One klal, which is helpful but also hurtful, is that kalim always, almost always, have less than 60 times, there's almost always less than 60 times the bleos in the content. To make sure I said that correctly, if I have, let's say, one kezias of tam absorbed in the walls of my pot, there's almost definitely less than 60 times that in the amount that the whole pot can hold. So it's not going to be more, the pot will not be able to hold more than 60 kezias of contents, of liquid.
And that is about how much dairy was in the pot.
Oh, very good. That's the way we're going to get around this. So it seems like there doesn't seem to make any sense. Why are you telling me, go based on Shishin, if we have this assumption, all kalim will never hold, no kalim will ever hold more than 60 times the contents of the walls. It just seems like a waste. You should have just said, the Ramah should have just said, it's going to be us there if it's Ben Yomo. Right? You're never going to have a pot which is more than 60 times the content. You're never going to get the bittul. You should always have a problem, assuming you're Mishar Bekulo. So there are three answers brought in the Shachet. Number one, maybe the Ramah was saying ineconomic. That's exactly what the Ramah was trying to say. It wasn't the clearest way he could have said it, but yeah, maybe that's the point. It's always going to be us there. Number two, second possible answer, there are some strange kalim out there. If they're very thin walls and like very long or very tall, very very long, very wide, there are some strange kalim out there where you could theoretically somehow get 60 times the bleos in the walls. Very not classic, but it exists. So maybe the Ramah said it the way he said it for those cases. This third one seems to be the most relevant and the most mica. If there's some way of figuring out how much tam is in the walls of the kli, then you don't need to assume based on the entire walls. You just assume based on what you know was absorbed. So what's an example? Let's say I have a pot where the walls could absorb five kezias. But I know that in the past 24 hours, I've only cooked 2 kezias in the pot. Why does 24 hours matter? Right, it's like a 3-year-old pot. Why should, it's had bleos for 3 years of Sunday breakfast. Why should 24 hours be the factor? Right, Tom Huggins, Pain of Vinyomo. Any milk paste which has been absorbed more than 24 hours ago is going to be Tom Huggins, Pain of Vinyomo, and therefore totally irrelevant to our discussion. So the only thing you need to remember is how much milk have I used in this pot over the past 24 hours? If you can answer that question, if I know that it was, let's say, only 2 kezias, I don't need to measure based on the 5 kezias of the total volume. I can measure based on only those 2 kezias. So at that point, it becomes much more shyer to actually get the bittul. If I have a pot which has the full volume of 150 kezias in the pot, and the volume of the pot itself, I know, is the metal part, the clean part itself, where we can have bleos, let's say, is 5 kezias. So 60 times the 5 kezias is 300 kezias. I'm never getting to 300 kezias in this pot. I can barely get to half that. But if I know that I only use 2 kezias of milk in this pot, then 2 times 60 is 120. If I was cooking with a full pot, then great, I had bittul. My pot's totally fine, the food's totally fine, everybody's happy, everything's good. So that's an important idea from the Ramah.
Why does that bittul give 2 times?
60 times. I have a pot which holds 150 kezias, and I know that I only use that pot recently with milk, with 2 kezias of milk. So 60 times 2 is 120. So I know that if I'm using my full capacity of 150 kezias in my big pot, then I have bittul. It's 150 is more than enough to be mevatel. The 2 kezias which were absorbed in the walls, all I really needed was 120, and I have more than that.
Like a compressor.
No, we go based on volume instead of weight. in terms of that. But no, the same way you measure volume for solids and liquids, it's all the same.
Okay, does that matter if you make an egg with like milk inside of it, would the whole egg be considered that volume?
That's the question. So that's a good way to say the question. You can also say the same question. Let's say you're making chicken soup. Right, so I have like one leg in my chicken soup that I'm making for Shabbos. That taste obviously spreads throughout the entire soup. So how much do I need to assume, how much phlegic taste has been absorbed into my phlegic pot? If you assume that the entire contents of the soup are fully phlegic, and therefore it's going to be a lot of phlegic taste absorbed, or do I say no, I should set up a ratio. The chicken leg is 1/30th of the contents of the soup, right? You have one chicken leg in a big chicken soup. You have the carrots in there, you have the zucchini in there, you have the celery, you have the dill, you got the water, you got a lot of stuff going on in your chicken soup. So my chicken leg is, let's say, 1/30th of all the other contents. So maybe, what did the walls of the clea absorb? 1/30th of phlegic taste. So if the clea itself is able to hold 30, let's say, kazaytim, only one kazayat of those 30 kazaytim is going to be a phlegic taste. That's obviously going to be very, very helpful. I have a 30 kazayat pot, so let's say the pot can hold 400 kazaytim, then it's going to be pretty simple to get a bitul b'shishim of just 1/30th of the walls of that pot. So similar question, what if I use milk in an omelette, do I see that as fully milky, or do I see, let's say, I don't know, one sixth of the omelette was milk, so the clea only absorbed 1/6 volume of milk taste? So that's a great question, a very important question, Lamaisa. In terms of sack we hold, we assume it absorbed the ratio, meaning not the entire amount, only that 1/2 amount is now absorbed in the walls. So for the chicken soup, only 1/30th phlegic taste is in the walls of my chicken soup pot. In the omelet case, only 1/6 of dairy taste is absorbed in the walls of my frying pan. Hugely helpful the next time you're using it, if you accidentally use it with the wrong type, much lower threshold in order to be bustled. That's very, very helpful. That comes from the pre-Megadim. Yeah, huge kula, and we do rely on this lamaita. So this is all Benyomo. In the case of Benyomo, unless you have shishim, you're going to have a problem. The way to measure shishim we spoke about. If you're Sephardi, maybe you can rely on Ti'i Maskefela, but for Ashkenazim, we have to go straight to shishim. And you measure based on last usage. We're going to quickly get into Einu Benyomo. There's not so much to talk about, but yeah.
So do you think for like whether you become phlegic or you know, if you have a gigantic pot with a small piece of chicken, then with the whole soup, we phlegic or...
That we see, I think we did, yes. That is discussed. I think it was paid test. And we said, make or I didn't, it seems like not, but in terms of minimum release, yes, you would have to wait after that. I think you said you have to wait for that thing also. That's like a potato in a chalon. Right, if you have a potato in a meat chalon, was cooked together with meat, but the potato itself is obviously not meat, so I think you said you would have to wait for 6 hours after that tasha, after that potato.
But it would still be an issue to cook meat and dairy, just like a tiny bit of drop of milk and a tiny bit of meat inside that soup dough. You cook it together.
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
Like if it's just in the soup pot, you put a drop of milk and a tiny piece of meat.
At the same time?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But if that does a little shishim or not?
What else is in the pot?
It's just like broth and vegetables.
And you both buzz around they're falling at the same time or different times? If they're falling at different times, you can probably say each one is bustle. If whichever one matters is bustle. But if they're falling at the same time, you may have a problem. Maybe. Okay, so what if the pot is made of Yomo, which is generally what's going to happen? So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the very, very end, two documents are full of important kasher sugyas at the very end of Avodah Zarah. This is on Ayin Hay and Beis. It says, technically, the Torah was only Oster Ben Yomo pot. However, we have a gzeira, a pretty mistaken, pretty logical gzeira, not to cook an Einu Benyomo pot, atu Benyomo. If you thought you were totally hefker and thought it was totally fine to cook in my Einu Benyomo pot, just trying to keep in mind when was the last time I used them, it's going to be very easy to make mistakes. So we said, don't use your Einu Benyomo pot, gzeira atu, the Benyomo one. So, L'chafila, you definitely should not be using any benyomo pot. Here, obviously, it's not L'chafila, it's very good. Yeah, but you made a mistake, you realize post facto, what do I do now? So, number one, the food. The food is totally fine. The food's totally fine because the only thing that went into this food, the only thing that went into my meatballs was a tam pogrom, a bad taste of milk, right? After 24 hours, the taste becomes pogrom, it's no longer good, and therefore it doesn't have the power to create any sort of problems. So the food is good. But what about the pot? This is very interesting. The pot has blios of milk from all those Sunday breakfasts. And now, they're bleos of meat, because I just made meatballs in the pot. So what's hanging out in this pot, somehow not combining, but bouncing around each other? You have bleos of milk, and bleos of plashik, somehow coexisting. It's like the Mach of Barad. You have fire and ice hanging out together, coming down and destroying the mitzvah. What is going on in this pot? What is it? Is it milchik? Is it plashik? Can I even use it at all? What am I supposed to do here? So the pot is a very interesting question. Even though you might say that the old tam, the milchik tam, is eno binyomo, is tagum, and now the fresh tam is meat, so I should use it with plashik, you're going to run into problems of lechatchila. If you start using this, you decide to make this into your meat pot, you're using dairy, eno binyomo, lechatchila with meat. You can't do that. Right, we just said it's gzeira and Abu Dazar ayin hay. So that's not the answer. If you try to go back to the first type and say, I'm going to keep this as my milchik pot, exact same problem. If it's within 24 hours, then you actually literally just scraped up the pot and the food because it's within 24 hours of the meat taste. But even past 24 hours, now you're using a lechachila with a binyomo of meat. That's not good either. What am I supposed to do? So, two options. Number one, this is being suggested, you can use it for parts. A big parrot says you can use it for noodles, you can use it for eggs, you can use it for fish, anything where you're not, there's no direct interaction of the tamim, of the bleos, with each other, it would be okay to use for parrot. This is for big parrot. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. There may be, you may, in some sense, be kashering the pot when you use it to cook the other type. When I use my milchik pot to cook meat, it seems like one of the Rishonim is saying that you're ki'ilu kashering the pot, getting all the old taste out, and then infusing it with new taste. That's pretty interesting. It could be that the eno binyomo tastes are not able to join together in the part of food to create problems. One shita says, different svaras in the Rishonim, one shita says, you'd be able to use it for part. And the Ramah actually seems to pass in that way. So that for shar, for kol shai dvarim, it's totally fine to use this pot. The Shach, though, points out right here, says, wait, slow down. Ramah, I know what you're saying here, but remember what you're going to write in Sadi Dalit. Just one simon away, the Ramah's going to tell us that we have it in a similar case, the same mechanics, the Ramah's going to say, we have a minhag not to use this pot at all. Even though technically you could be using it for parts, you're not creating full-fledged sister, it looks really weird. It looks really sketchy. How can I use a pot that I know has bleos of both basar and challah to cook food? Isn't that just straight trace? How is that, even though technically it's okay, we understand why, eino binyomo, tam tagum, it looks really off, so there must be we have a minhag not to use it. The Shach says, whatever you said over there definitely should apply here, and we're going to pass them like that Shach. So, end of the day. If you have an eino binyomo pot that cooks the wrong type, you should kasher that pot, assuming it's kasherable. Assuming it's metal, you should do hagalah, do what you need to do. We'll get into the details of hagalah at a different time. So we said, binyomo, the first question you need to be able to answer is binyomo versus eino binyomo. If it's binyomo, then you need to figure out if there was a mesinas tam, that's either through ti'imat kfeila, asking a goy to taste it if you're Sparty, or if you're Ashkenazi, determining shishim, figuring out 60 times the last blia from within the past 24 hours. If it's eino binyomo, the food's definitely okay. The question is, what do you do with the pot? And our pshat is that you should kasher the pot before you use it again. Just one note, if you're dealing with the Dabar Harif, all of this flies out the window, none of this is relevant anymore, because the Eino Binyomo Heter no longer applies. So you're dealing with straight milk taste, fresh milk taste, interacting with meat, straight up meat, you have straight pots, straight food, and everything straight, go call your rabbi and recast in your kitchen. Dabar Harif makes things very, very complicated, we'll try to deal with them in a future shir. But this is the basic outline of what happens if you use the wrong pot for cooking milk or dairy. Here's the basic outline. Probably still helpful to call your rabbi and talk it through, but here's at least you know the essentials.